Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Well, now the fate of President Obama's key legislative achievement is in the hands of the Supreme Court. After 3 days of oral public arguments, the nine justices will deliberate in private the fate of the Affordable Health Care Act. By June, we expect to learn whether the court will uphold or reject the sweeping health care overhaul. In the last day of arguments, the justices explored whether the law can remain in place if they reject its key component, the mandate that everyone have or buy health insurance. The justices seem to agree with the administration that the law may not be able to survive without the insurance mandate. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg laid out the court's decision while questioning the attorney arguing for scrapping the entire bill.
So why shouldn't we say it's a choice between a wrecking operation, which is what you are requesting, or a salvage job? And the more conservative approach would be salvage rather than throwing out everything.
The court also heard arguments that the law's expansion of Medicaid puts too large a burden on states such as Ohio. Joining us to analyze the final day of arguments and guide us through what happens next is Ohio State University law professor Ruth Kolker. Welcome to the show, Ruth.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
On Tuesday, the justices seemed very skeptical of the government should be able to mandate that its citizens buy health insurance. But yesterday, they seemed to understand the argument that the mandate is the foundation of the health care law. Can we read anything into that?
Well, on yesterday, the court was trying to answer the counterfactual. If we would conclude that this statute is unconstitutional, at least the individual mandate provision is unconstitutional, what should we do as a matter of remedy? And that's a very difficult question for the court because it's a 970-page document. And should it strike down the entire document or should it leave much of it intact and just strike down individual mandate or maybe something a bit more than that? And that's a very, very difficult technical question when you have a statute as massive as this.
Now, was it Justice Scalia that referred to a 2,300-page document?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how he got a 2,300-page. On my PDF, it's about 960, 970.
Well, they exaggerate. On Tuesday, the administration defended the mandate, and on Wednesday it said two key parts of the law, including the guaranteeing insurance for pre-existing conditions, cannot survive without it. So what is the administration arguing for at this point?
Well, this is an interesting case where neither party wanted to defend the lower court. So the Supreme Court had to ask a third lawyer to defend the lower court. The lower court had held that the individual mandate could be struck down and the rest of the statute could stay intact. The administration's position is that that would essentially bankrupt the insurance industry because if we get rid of the individual mandate and still require insurance companies to insure people irrespective of pre-existing conditions, then unfortunately someone could wait until they have a massive heart attack and then send a letter to the insurance company saying, oh, now I want to buy your insurance for $100 a month. Oh, yeah, it might cost you $2 million, but too bad the statute requires you to insure me. So the administration understands that that's sort of an untenable position to put the insurance companies in. So it's offering the argument that two of the provisions would have to go along with the individual mandate.
And those two provisions would be?
The provision about pre-existing conditions and another provision about how much the insurance company could charge people by considering their risk factors to keeping down the cost of insurance, making it affordable.
My guest is Ruth Kolker. She's a professor at the OSU Moritz College of Law. We're talking about the last day of arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday regarding the Health Care Reform Act that is up for grabs at this point. They're going to decide in June, right? Or their decision should come out in June. Have they ever come out later than June?
Yes, they've come down about as late as July 3rd or 4th. Well, actually not on the 4th itself, but usually by July 4th, we can expect they've all gone home and gone on vacation.
They don't like putting things off, do they?
Well, this is a very complicated
exactly.
decision. I don't know if putting off is a fair description. If they would conclude, if a majority would conclude this statute is unconstitutional, they will have to think about the 960 pages of the statute and decide what to strike and what not to strike. And the liberal members of the court who are likely to uphold the statute will get the vote on that part of the case also. So this is an issue that really concerns all nine members of the court, and that's why each of the nine members, except for Justice Thomas, who's always quiet, was really quite engaged yesterday.
Ohio and 25 other states argue that the law is too much of a burden when it comes to the Medicaid component. What exactly is their complaint?
It's an interesting argument. What Congress has done is very considerably expand Medicaid by saying that I believe those who are within 150% of the poverty level would now be covered. That would mean many millions more Americans would be covered by Medicaid. States administer Medicaid. It's a cooperative arrangement between the federal government and the state government. So obviously, if Medicaid is extended in this massive way, the state would have more of an obligation to its citizens to be providing this benefit. Medicaid's an enormously complicated, huge federal program, and the state's only option would be to opt out of the program itself if it doesn't want to agree to this latest expansion. So Ohio and other states are objecting to that expansion.
Was it Justice Thomas or Justice Roberts that said, hey, you wanted to tie these purse strings, you know, the states did it in the first place, and now the federal government's pulling those strings?
Well, it wasn't Justice Thomas because
okay.
He's never said a
word. I was going to say, but I think it was Justice Roberts.
I don't remember
okay.
distinctly who said this. But it's an interesting situation. It's a cooperative federal-state arrangement, which Federalists typically like. But their argument is, the Federalist argument, is this got to the point of being coercive. And Justice Kennedy, I think, had the most interesting exchange here. He said, really, can't we describe this as intruding on a state sovereignty, telling them how to run a massive state program? And there is case law when the federal government is impinging on a state sovereignty, it has then crossed the boundaries between constitutional and unconstitutional conduct. So that's the line that Justice Kennedy was trying to contemplate yesterday.
Bill and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you. For your guests, why did the government exclude the severability clause, which is basic legal jargon, if you will, and cause all the problems? Why did they leave that out? Every contract has that, whether it's information technology or, in this case, healthcare. I don't understand it.
You mean in the legislation itself?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it all comes down to what deal Congress can agree to.
Well, what is a severability clause first? What is
a severability clause is a clause Congress often adds to statutes that says if any particular part is struck down, the rest of the statute stands. That's
okay.
A very typical thing for Congress to say. I guess Congress couldn't agree to that statement in this instance for the reasons that we saw in yesterday's oral argument. It would have probably not made sense as a matter of policy that neither the Republicans nor the Democrats would have agreed to this notion. They strike down the individual mandate, the rest of the statute would survive. It really can't because, as the Obama administration admits, the insurance industry would go bankrupt if it had to offer insurance to everyone without a larger group to insure.
But there were components of the law that don't have anything to do with health care reform or health care insurance, they were saying.
Well, there are parts of the law that, by going into effect, would not arguably bankrupt the insurance industry, some of which are highly popular. Many of us have children under the age of 26 and are very happy to be able to now cover them by a statute that Ohio has now also adopted. So there are many popular provisions of the statute that don't seem to rise or fall in terms of their affordability based on the individual mandate rule.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Take care. So, like I said earlier, so I think it was Justice Scalia mentioned something like 2,300 pages. You say 900 something. But regardless, that's a lot of information to consume. Do the justices actually read all of that stuff anyways? Would they? Could they? Or is it pretty much their clerks that do that heavy lifting?
Well, there was an interesting, I think, humorous exchange between Justice Scalia and one of the lawyers saying, well, I guess my clerks are going to have to read it. And then later, when the lawyer said, I guess your clerk's going to have to read it, he goes, oh, no, I will. So I don't think they ever want to admit that their clerks do all the heavy lifting. But, I mean, I have sat down to try to read this statute, but, you know, a nap interceded. I mean, it's very difficult to read 900-some pages. How many members of Congress, maybe that's the more important body, have read 960, 970
of
pages?
Anything?
Maybe.
So now let's go back to the timing. Do they have to bring forth a ruling by July, or is that just a date they're probably shooting for? Could they wait until after the election if they wanted to?
No. They have to, well, let me put it this way. It would be unprecedented for them to not decide by July 3rd, unless they decide they need to have further arguments. Sometimes the court, as in the famous case Roe versus Wade that you probably have heard of, Brown versus Board of Education, another case you probably have heard of, in those two very famous cases, the court asked for a re-argument on a particular sub-issue that they felt they hadn't sufficiently contemplated. In that case, they'd have re-argument in October, and a decision would be rendered in the next term. But there's no reason to think that would happen in this instance.
And how different is this case from challenges to Social Security, Medicare, and the Civil Rights Act? We often, you know, forget that there was a lot of argument about that.
This case is obviously on the list of attacks to statutes enacted by Congress. That seems to be a historical trend that would take place. So, you know, when the constitutional law history books are written, obviously this case will be on the list of similarly very, very important cases.
And if the Supreme Court likes to stay out of the branches, other branches of government, of course, in its history, has it ever overturned a piece of legislation as significant as this? Or is that why it would end up in the history books, is what you're saying?
That's an interesting question. Obviously, when they overturned the campaign finance reform statute, that received a lot of attention and controversy. Was that as important as this? I mean, you know, obviously Obama considers this to be the signature statute of his administration to this time, so it would be a very significant political blow to his administration, I would think, if their key piece of legislative success is overturned by the courts. The court just last week overturned half of the Family Medical and Leave Act, but that's an overstatement. They overturned the provision of it. That was obviously a key piece of President Clinton's administration. So sometimes key pieces of laws are overturned.
Sooner or later.
That's right.
Terry in Youngstown, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Terry.
Yes. And I'd like to know if you could ask your guest, if this law is struck down, will the Massachusetts health care law be struck down, too? Because they're saying that these two laws are modeled after each other.
You want me to answer that?
Yeah. Ruth Kolker?
That's a great question. The Massachusetts law was passed under Massachusetts state constitution. The argument that's being made here is that the federal government, the Congress, is a branch of government with limited enumerated powers, and that the argument is that it exceeded its powers in enacting this law. So to ask the question whether the Massachusetts law is constitutional, the question would be, did it follow the Massachusetts Constitution, their state constitution? And I'm not an expert, obviously, on the Massachusetts state constitution, but there's no reason to believe that it was unconstitutional under their state constitution. If the argument had been made that somehow this statute violated individual liberty interest, as if this is an individual rights argument, which it is not, then a federal decision would implicate the states. But that's not the argument here. This is all about Congress's power, and the answer to Congress's power has no bearing on the state's power.
Thanks, Terry. Well, Ruth Kolker, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Ruth Kolker, she's a professor at the OSU Moritz College of Law. When we return, we'll be chatting with Julie Zickafoos, author and natural historian. Her latest book is called The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. You know there will be bird sounds. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, sizing up Ben Bernanke. The economy's getting traction. How's the Fed chief done? How's he doing? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point is this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 48 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, warming up to a high near 58 degrees. Clear skies for tonight and a low right around 37. And then a mix of sun and clouds for Friday. Expect showers and thunderstorms in the late afternoon, a high of 65 degrees. More rain for Friday night and a low of 41. Be sure to visit WOSU.org/allsides for the latest from All Sides with Ann Fisher. You can also explore the All Sides archive, which includes audio and video of every show. That's WOSU.org/allsides. And the program continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
She learned to fix broken birds at the knee of her father, who was raised on a farm and knew how to nurture creatures. But artist and natural historian Julie Zickefoos takes her calling a step further by sharing the stories of the birds with the rest of us. Her new book is called The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds, and the variety of birds runs the gamut from the tern to the cussing titmouse. Julie began illustrating natural history as a college freshman in 1976. Her writing since then has been featured in Birdwatcher's Digest, on NPR's All Things Considered, and in her book of illustrated essays, Letters from Eden. She joins us today from her home in Southern Ohio. Welcome back to the show, Julie.
Oh, hi, Anne. I really missed your voice.
Oh,
great,
thank you. I've missed you too. You know, the last time we talked, we did talk about the bluebird effect, but it was in black and white.
Yeah.
Now I have the final product, and wow.
Yeah, the book was released March 20th, and I actually got my first shipment in late February, and I've been sending them out like a one-armed paper hanger ever since. It's been quite an adventure. I've sent over 260 copies out of my home studio in less than 3 weeks.
When I was reading an essay that you wrote, I think it was about the osprey. I might be wrong, but it was someone he had asked you to study them or to illustrate a paper they were writing about them or something.
Yeah, a sort of a nascent book that never really came to be.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought it was interesting the way you described the process that you go through and how important it is to you to really spend some time with the birds, watching them.
Yeah, and, you know, there are so many times when I've stopped and said a little prayer of thanks to the fact that I was young enough to do that, that before I had kids and you know, people expecting things from me, that I could really sit on a dock for weeks at a time and just be with ospreys.
Before I want to talk to you about that, but first let's listen to the osprey. It's an interesting sound. So is that like one bird or two birds?
That's one bird, and the sort of you're hearing, that is a very, very ticked off osprey.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's probably taken, recorded by someone standing right under a nest, and the bird is circling overhead, and it's so angry that it's not even getting all the peeps out. You know, it's like, it's choking up on its anger.
It's a cursing osprey.
Yes, yes.
So you talk about you were so grateful to have the time to do that because you didn't have children, you didn't have a regular job at the time. Why does it take so much time to observe an osprey?
Well, you know, as I say in the chapter of the book, I really had to enter osprey time because, I mean, when you're just watching a nest of birds, nothing happens for minutes on end, hours on end. And then once you sort of get into the rhythm of their lives and you realize, you know, well, Dad should be due about now with a fish, and then you see one cock its eye at the sky and you see it come to alert and you watch for the father and he's just a speck in the distance and here he comes bearing a fish, your heart races just like theirs does. And that's when you know you're completely empathizing with the birds and that you've entered their time and you're no longer in your human time frame, you're in bird time frame, and that is a delicious place to be.
At first you were concerned, you thought maybe something was wrong because they were so laid back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I just thought, man, these things, they think they get fed more often.
Don't they feed their children?
Right, but the deal is that, you know, they bring in a big fish, and then everybody eats off that for quite a while, and then they go off and try to find another big fish. So, yeah, it's just a whole different rhythm than I'm used to with the songbirds that I rehabilitate.
Plus, they're a really cool-looking bird.
Oh, they're a fabulous bird, yeah. It's such fun to draw. Really, really great architecture on those birds, and just a ball. I just love drawing ospreys.
They're the head gear they have.
Yeah, and they've got a wonderful black mask through the eyes.
Yeah.
That serves a function. If you're looking into sunshot water and, you know, the light is bouncing everywhere, you have these black marks through your eyes to help cut the glare.
And then those talons.
Yeah, amazing talons. They have
wow.
Actually different from any other raptor. They have a completely circular cross-section on the talon as opposed to a semicircular cross-section. And that is so that they will release the fish more easily.
You know, as I'm looking on page 101 at the dad and a baby, it's
yeah.
just a pencil sketch.
Yeah. Yeah.
So much personality in it.
Yeah, you know, I'm not really a cartoonist. I'm just not wired that way. But every once in a while, I'll just empathize so strongly with a bird that something comes out looking like a caricature, and that certainly did.
Also, you know, I realized reading the book this time how much I love the titles of your essays.
Oh, thank you.
And, of course, The Bluebird Effect is the title of one of the essays. It's also the title of the book. There's Chickadee Tough Tit. the rose-breasted grosbeak, Close Encounters of the Bird Kind, mm-hmm. and my favorite, Nobody Can Cuss Like a Titmouse.
It's the truth, man. It's I had this titmouse, and I was trying to see if he had any broken bones. And I wet him down, which is what you do to get the feathers out of the way. And that bird, and the other thing you do is you gently manipulate the wing bones, and you listen for what's called crepitation, which is the ends of two broken bones rubbing against each other.
Or the sound of my knees. Yeah.
Yeah, I crepitate quite frequently. This morning, in fact. So I have this bird wet down. I'm listening for crepitation. There's no chance I'm going to hear it because he's yelling his head off. They are very, very vocal birds.
The book is organized by seasons too. I don't know why I didn't notice this the first time. Maybe because now that it's in living color, these things popped out at me. But you organize it by seasons.
Well, you know, Anne, one of the great problems of organizing a natural history book is just what do you do? You know, I couldn't really do it taxonomically because I cover 25 different species of birds in the book, but they're so widely disparate, you know, there's just no organizing them in a taxonomic way. And I always go back to the seasons because that's how my life is ordered. I'm so close to nature and so tied into what's happening every day that it just, I think all my books will be ordered by seasons, no matter what they're about. Toilet cleaners, you know, it doesn't matter.
There's a season for that too?
Oh, yeah. It's not now, I can tell you that.
The Bluebird Effect. Let's just talk about the title of the book, mm-hmm. the title of one of the essays. Why that?
Well, first off, that title took me a couple of years to come up with. And by the time I finally came up with it and decided that was the title I wanted, I was desperate for everyone to like it as much as I did. So I wrote this 2-page screed to my editor when she first responded that she wasn't that crazy about the title. I said, here's why this has to be the title. The deal is, you know, I think a lot of us have heard of the butterfly effect, which is a sort of a fantastic notion that a butterfly flapping its wings somewhere in South America could set up a gentle breeze that would then compound and cause a tornado in the northern hemisphere. It's a sort of a premise, you know, that one tiny event somewhere else can set off a huge event far, far away. And it's a neat concept. In my case, I called this the bluebird effect because we saved a bluebird from a sharp-shin hawk in our front yard. And it wasn't anything, we weren't trying to deny the hawk its rightful prey. It's just that we were very fond of this bluebird. And when a hawk grabbed it off the clothesline, without even thinking, we waved our arms and made the hawk drop the bird. Well, I picked him up, and he seemed okay. There was a little bit of blood, but there were no broken bones. You can test for crepitation in a bluebird because they're very quiet. And so there were no broken bones, so I let him go because he was feeding a brood in a box in our yard. And we didn't see him much for a week. He sort of moped in the woods, and when he finally started feeding his brood again, his left wing drooped badly. And so we knew we had the same bird. He went on to live another 8 years in our yard, and I followed his every move. and got him through disease and a bad molt session and saw him raise his young. And he raised 67 young in our yard in 8 years. So that was, I call that the bluebird effect, because that one small act of waving our arms at a predator set off this wonderful series of events and this relationship with this bird that went on for seven more years.
My guest is Julie Zicafus, natural history writer, artist, author, and NPR commentator. We're talking about her new book. It's out now. It's called The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. If you have a question or comment for Julie, you know you're welcome. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there, or you could tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Let's listen to another bird sound. You talk about the mourning dove as a meaty bird. First, let's listen to the poor thing before you chop him up.
The poor thing.
Okay, that other sound in there sounds like a big semi switching gears.
Sounds like
but...
garbage morning, right?
Exactly. Friday morning in my neighborhood. So, the meatiest songbird, why that title?
Oh, my gosh, I like that title, the meatiest songbird. Well, you know, mourning doves are regarded by some as game birds, and by others, like me, as well, they aren't exactly technically songbirds. Their syrinx isn't constructed properly to be actually a songbird, but a lot of other people consider them, you know, beautiful songbirds that live in their yard that they love to feed millet to. So there's this great chasm between those who would use them as living targets and those who would just enjoy them for their beauty and their soft song. So in the chapter, I sort of explore that sort of dichotomy of, you know, this bird that's regarded in two different ways by two very different sets of people.
You know, I remember when I was covering the State House and there was the lobbying for the mourning dove bill.
Right.
And the hunters that I talked to said they think it's a beautiful bird and they love hearing the mourning dove.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I shouldn't make it sound as though you can't love something that you shoot. Certainly, I suppose you could. I know that a lot of hunters have a great deal of respect for them, and I've learned since I wrote the essay in here that a lot of people do actually eat them. But I think the thing that I focused on in my chapter was some of the information that came out from the pro-hunting ballot issue was just, I found just so laughable. One dove equals 10 large shrimp, one chicken leg, 2 chicken wings, 2.5 wieners, 3 sausage patties, or 1 bratwurst. And I thought, man, that's really something, because from my studies in skinning birds that had been killed by cars or windows, mm-hmm. I knew that the breast of a mourning dove weighed less than 2 ounces. So I thought, man, those are really small wieners and shrimp. Maybe they're popcorn.
What a ripoff.
Right,
<Yeah.
laughs> right. So I went and I weighed the breast of a mourning dove, and then I weighed a wiener, and I found that the breast of a mourning dove actually equals about half of a wiener.
So there,
gun lobby. but actually, you know, the mourning dove is now a game bird in Ohio.
Yep.
And I will say this, I have never actually seen people hunting mourning doves in my area. So I don't know how popular it is. I imagine it's quite popular in some agricultural
areas. It was a big deal back in the day, but
yeah.
I don't either. Is the great backyard bird count over this year now?
Oh, yeah, that's sort of...
That's early March?
January, I think.
Oh, it's January.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay. So how did that go, or did you participate?
I was running around too much
okay.
to do it. Yeah, unfortunately, that's one of the things about being having the metabolism of a flaming shrew. You don't sit still.
But you did participate last year, right?
Yeah, a couple of years ago I did quite avidly, but yeah, I happened to be out of town this time.
What's coming up this spring?
Well,
the Great Migration.
Well, yeah, you know, it's interesting. Every morning when I go out running, I'd make a list of all the birds that I hear singing, and that gives me a really good idea of what migrants have gotten in. And I had only one migrant this morning, and that was the golden-crowned kinglet. So we are still on the very, very early edge of migration, although some birds are starting to show up. I'm still waiting for the first blue-gray gnatcatcher. They're due any day now.
Is it at all changed by the weather patterns, like our poor flowers and plants are?
Oh, boy, you know, the plants are sure going through it right now.
Yeah.
Have you had anything bitten by frost?
Actually, we did have a really bad frost here a couple days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Our stuff seemed to come out okay, but other people had stuff covered up.
Yeah, I know. I saw a lot of people covering things, too.
I told
my plants to just deal with it.
I forgot.
Yeah.
I even did a show about it, and I still forgot.
It's painful. It really is. You know, I'm sweating my budding lilac through every cold night. I'm just hoping.
Yeah.
But, you know, the birds, so far, there have been some very early water thrushes, which are early migrants anyway. There have been some very early pine warblers coming through. And again, these are cold-adapted birds that are quite used to foraging for dormant insects, like scale insects.
They'd be early anyways?
They'd be early anyway, yeah. But so far, so good on the migrant front. I have heard anecdotal reports of a hummingbird in the Cleveland area, which would be very, very unusual. They're usually due around April 17th in southern Ohio. But so far, what I'm observing here is that things are more or less on time.
Does it concern you that they could get off kilter? And would that be a problem if all of a sudden the migration patterns did change somewhat?
Well, I don't think that one strange climatic spring is going to change migration patterns in birds at all, really. I think that the ones that might be tempted to travel a little faster would be some of the insectivores, you know, that are just simply following the abundance of insects as they come north. But birds are a lot tougher than we give them credit for. Most wildlife is. And I remember a spring a few years ago when there were a string of nights in the 20s in late May. And that was a real shock to everything, but it was amazing to see the birds just sail right through it. And I've stood among flocks of migrating warblers in Wisconsin on the shore of the Great Lake there, watching migrating warblers forage in snow. So they are tougher than we give them credit for. They don't just up and die, you know, when it gets a little chilly.
You know, this morning when I was walking, it was just like a symphony out there this morning. There were so many birds. It was so fantastic. And I think I finally isolated the robin cardinal.
Yeah.
But I think I mentioned it to Ken Kaufman one time that it just doesn't seem like there's much singing in the winter. And he said, well, yeah, there are birds in the winter. They sing in the morning, but it just doesn't seem like as many.
Well, no, they don't. They don't have the necessary hormones coursing through their blood to make them want to sing. They're there, but they just aren't singing. And let me just for fun read you off the list of birds that I counted in active song this morning.
Okay.
European starling, field sparrow, eastern meadowlark, brown thrasher, northern mockingbird, white-breasted nuthatch, chipping sparrow, Carolina wren, tufted titmouse, northern flicker, red-winged blackbird, mourning dove, American robin, eastern towhee, downy woodpecker, Carolina chickadee, eastern phoebe, blue jay, song sparrow, American crow, pileated woodpecker, northern cardinal, brown-headed cowbird, house sparrow, and golden-crowned kinglet. And that is just...
And you're taking all your medications.
I'm taking all my medications. That's just me with a little scrap of paper and a pen in my hand, scribbling as I run and noting the things that I'm hearing. And this is something that you can get a lot better at with practice, just sifting the songs in your brain and then picking out the individual ones that you recognize and writing those down. And as you begin to recognize more and more, it gets more and more satisfying.
My guest is Julie Zicafus, natural history writer, artist, author, and NPR commentator. Her new book is called The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. We'll get back to it when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Receive daily updates from WOSU by liking our station on Facebook or by following WOSU News on Twitter. Another way to connect with us is by subscribing to our daily News Loop e-newsletter. Visit wosu.org/email to sign up.
This is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins in a discussion of intimacy after age 50. Join us for that discussion during All Sides at 11.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Wexner Center, presenting Kid Pivot Frankfurt RM. Canadian choreographer Crystal Pite and her dance ensemble will perform their latest touring program March 29th in the Thurber Theater. Tickets and more details at wexarts.org.
As a basic member to 89.7 NPR News, your membership starts at just $60 and helps keep the news you enjoy on the air. Make your first-time gift or renew your basic membership and get the WOSU member card, too. That's WOSU.org, and thanks for your support. Sunshine today and a high near 58 degrees, clear skies for tonight and a low of 37. Expect a mix of sun and clouds on Friday, thunderstorms and rain showers likely in the late afternoon, a high of 65. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm talking with Julie Zicafus, natural history writer, artist, author, and NPR commentator. Her newest book just came out this month, The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. If you have a question or comment for Julie Zicafus, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can go onto our Facebook page as well. Barry in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Barry.
Hi. First, let me just say that of all of your guests, Julie is definitely my favorite.
Aww. One of mine, too.
You know, the USDA recently changed Columbus's growing season from, I think, a region five, or I changed the region from five to six.
Yes.
How is that going to, because of global warming, how is that going to affect migratory patterns?
Well, I don't know that the USDA's designation is going to mean a lot to the birds, but I know exactly what you mean. We got bumped up to 6.2 down here in southeast Ohio, and this is something that had been growing on me as a gardener for a long time. I mean, I've got a crepe myrtle coming into bud here, which is a great southern shrub that I grew up with in Virginia, and I wouldn't have tried to grow it here 21 years ago, but I was emboldened by recent weather patterns to try it, and it's doing great. So I think that change has been dramatic, and I think it's been very swift and a little bit frightening. And yeah, I too wonder how the migratory patterns and the breeding ranges of birds will be affected. One interesting thing that I've noticed in the 21 years we've lived here is that tree swallows, which are primarily a sort of a northern northeastern species, have moved into our area and begun breeding. They're breeding in all my bird boxes. And here's the really interesting thing. They're raising two broods per season in my boxes, which is something that I had never before observed in tree swallows. And I've been running boxes since 1981. But they seem to be taking advantage of this new range expansion into this area with a longer breeding season and breaking with what we consider to be a sort of a hardwired, single-brooded predisposition to now be able to raise two broods. So birds are very plastic. They respond very fluidly and very quickly to changes in their environment, including climate. And I think that's one of the things that we're starting to see.
Thanks, Barry.
Bye.
Take care. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Andrea from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I just wanted to find out the name of a bird that I hear in the morning. I call it my bird, even though it's flying around outside all the time. It sits outside my window, and it has a very distinctive call. But I don't know the name of the bird, and I just wanted to find out from your guest if she could identify the bird for me.
You're going to have to do the call, Andrea.
I'm going to try my best. I've been practicing.
This is like car talk.
I can't wait.
But with birds. Okay.
It goes. And sometimes it will add another little whistle every time, and sometimes I'll listen, and it'll add another. So it kind of goes like that. So
okay.
I can do it again, and if that didn't sound very clear.
You know, I'm thinking, and is it invariably that pattern?
It's that pattern, and then at the end, it tends to add one more little
do that for us.
Whistle.
You're pretty good.
It goes, okay, I'll try. I hear it every morning. It's so pretty, and I love hearing the birds in the morning. It goes, and it adds one more, like, and then it adds one more. Every call, it seems to add one more at the end.
How would you describe the quality of the voice? Is it a clear ringing whistle, very loud?
It's very clear. It's not a harsh sound. It's just a very gentle.
It's more melodious.
Yes, it's kind of melodious.
Okay.
And it, and the bird just adds one more little sound at the end. I'm not sure. I wouldn't call it a chirp. I would call
Would you call it more of a trill or a chirr?
Maybe,
okay.
Like a trill. And it adds one more at the end each time, so it's just like, it goes. And it just adds like one more
I think
more
I've heard that
time.
Before.
Yeah, it's a beautiful little sound.
Okay, well, nothing is really hitting me in the face about this, but there are a couple of birds that people consistently mention to me as being a bird that they notice, and one is the tufted titmouse, which this I'm not suggesting for this. The other is a Carolina wren. And that is a bird that will sing right around your porch, right around your windows, and has a very clear and somewhat variable song. The usual verbal interpretation is tea kettle, tea kettle, tea kettle, that kind of thing. But they vary it a great deal, and they also have a variety of low chirrs and brrrr kind of sounds that they do as well. So I'm leaning toward Carolina Wren on this, but I'm going to be thinking about that.
You know what I thought was interesting, Julie? I don't know if it was you or somebody else I was talking to once explained to me that different birds in within a species have different sounds.
Oh, yes.
Not all birds.
Oh, yes.
Not all robins sound alike.
Oh, not at all.
But
yeah, we can tell individual towhees in our woods. You know, we have some with a very metallic tone to their voice and some with a much more melodious tone. We have some that say the whole drink your tea and some that just say drink your. You know, so yeah, there's a great deal of variation. And Andrea, I would very much encourage you, if you're hearing this bird all the time, get a pair of binoculars. Sit quietly and watch for it. That's how you learn bird song.
Yeah, do you know what it looks like, Andrea?
Well, I went outside to see if I, you know, wouldn't scare it away, and I think it might be like a little blackbird. But then I'm not sure. I'm like, well, I'm not sure. Was that the bird I heard? Or?
Yeah, beg, borrow, or steal a pair of binoculars and trace that sound to the beak of the bird and give us another call when I'm on again.
Okay, thank you so much.
Or you can go to juliezickafoos.com and hit my comment box, and we'll talk about it. And the other thing you could do is hold up a cell phone and make a recording.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, that's real easy to do, and that would give you, I could tell you right off the bat what you had.
Okay.
Okay, yep. All right, I will.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Have a good day.
Thanks for the call. We do have another sound. We have a couple calls I want to get to, but you write about love with the chestnut-fronted macaw.
Yes.
So let's listen to it first.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I have a question for you.
Right.
Hello, is that a cat with a hairball or what?
I remember that sound.
What's to love, Julie?
What's to love? Well, it's the personality. You don't love them for their voice, that's for sure.
What story do you tell about that bird?
Oh, I tell the story of living for 23 years with the same macaw, and I think, you know, regular listeners to your program will remember that very sad program when we talked about, you know, my losing Charlie to egg binding and going through that whole grieving process. And you know, it's funny, I was just mowing around Charlie's grave last night, and I thought, I miss Charlie, but I don't miss having a macaw. Isn't that funny?
Well, I think I know what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
I think anyone who's had a pet a long time that had issues but loved it anyways knows what you mean.
Yes.
But, I actually love the sound of the macaw. It cracks me up. It's hysterical.
As long as you don't hear it every day, it's great.
I hear it all 3-4 times a year.
Right, exactly. It cracks
you up. When I talk to you.
Right, as long as it's not in your living room.
Yeah, so how are you doing?
I'm doing great, actually. I really am. And I have a dear friend who does parrot rescue through ravenshaven.org. And she is... she's finally stopped sending me pictures of parrots that need forever homes because as I said to her the last time, I said, I've done my time. 23 years with a macaw is enough.
We have an email from Violet. She writes, personally, I do not believe in feeding wild animals due to their becoming dependent on humans for their livelihood. How do you feel about that?
Well, that's very interesting. I think that's fine. I think it's a perfectly upright stance to take. I think, though, that for those of us who really enjoy birds, you're missing a lot of fun by not feeding. And I don't consider wildlife toys anything but I think there is a general sort of a misconception that birds depend on us for the food we offer. They don't. They include us on their lines of foraging. They make our yard a stop in their day, and they grace us with their presence. But do they depend on us completely? Absolutely not. I think humans tend to give themselves much too much credit on that front.
Jerry in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Good morning. My favorite bird overall is this one. Identify.
Wow, it sounds a little bit like a peacock from what I can hear. But
That is the Gavia immer, or common loon, which in Europe it's known as the Great Northern Diver. And I don't know who said it. I tried to look it up one time, but I'm not on the Internet. I have to use a public library. But anyway, they said the sound of the loon is the real voice of the wilderness.
Where does that recording come from, please?
Oh, well, you talked about Wisconsin. I bought this little stuffed loon a number of years ago.
Okay. Sounds a little funny to me. It didn't have the...
It was muffled by the stuffing.
Right. Well, it didn't have the clear, mellow quality of a loon. It had a more of a harsh sound to it. I think the battery's getting a little low.
That may be in the technology translation. But my other one, and I'd like to let your listeners know, the Kirtland Warbler, which is named after Dr. Kirtland, who was from Ohio.
Yes.
And they can go up in the first part of June to the little town of Mio, M-I-O, Michigan, and they only nest in jack pines, and if they get taller than 15 or 20 feet, they move on. And I don't know, Ms. Ziegefuss, if you know what the last census of the Kirtland Warbler was.
I don't have that number on the top of my head, but they're doing pretty well. They're over 1,000 now, aren't they, singing males?
When we were up there, they were about less than 500, 490, I believe.
Uh-huh.
But we went out, Forest Service, National Forest Service, is right across from Mickey D's in this little town of 500 people, and we went out with a guide from Upper Sandusky. I forgot his name now, but anyway, it's the first part of June, and if you call that National Forest, what you do is get there at 7:30, and they show you a film about the Kirtland Warbler.
Right.
But I just thought I'd like to pass that on for anybody wants to see.
Here we go. In the 2011 annual census, a total of 1,828 singing males were counted. So that's very good news.
Oops. Thanks, Jerry.
You made my day, Ms. Diggifuss.
Well,
thank you, Ms. Fisher, for the time.
Take care, Jerry.
I've actually been up to Mio and made the pilgrimage to Michigan to see that amazing, amazing warbler. So worth doing.
Thad in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Thad.
Thank you. You have one of the most wonderful shows. You have so many interesting topics, and today I just happened to be tuning in about the birding. And the lady there, I was wondering, has she ever been to Dalisod in the Monongahela National Forest in
West
Virginia?
I adore that place, one of my favorite places on the planet.
Yes, a lot of people don't seem to know that area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was there a year and a half ago with a friend who invited me for their banning in the fall there.
Yes.
And it was quite a spectacular area.
It's extraordinary. It's an alpine tundra situation. It's got tiny, tiny little alpine flowers and plants on a mountaintop. It's a barren, actually.
Yes, it was quite wonderful. I was wondering, is there any other birding areas close? I mean, I go to Black Lick a lot, but I was wondering, any other real classic birding areas that's close to 100 miles or so around?
Well, Julie, around Columbus, thanks, Dad, for that call.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, there's just the cemeteries. Green Lawn is famous for, I think they've had Merlins there, and that's the cemeteries right in Columbus are fantastic. The Dawes Arboretum in Newark is wonderful. The lake there right near Newark, is that Buckeye Lake?
Yes.
Yes, that can be really wonderful. There are a lot of wonderful bird. That would be an easy Google search, birding in Columbus. And I would also recommend my friend Jim McCormick's blog, Ohio Birds and Biodiversity. He treats a great many areas around Columbus in his blog. It would be a great reference for you, Jim McCormick.
Yep, Jim McCormick. He also has a column in the Dispatch.
Yes.
Thad, thanks for that call. Harold, we're running out of time, but I wanted to squeeze you in. Welcome to the show, Harold.
Hi, thank you very much. I miss whippoorwills, and I'm wondering how they're doing and where I can hear whippoorwills.
Well, you really need to go to the Appalachian regions of Ohio. We've got them breeding right on our front porch here in the Whippoorwill area. And, it's kind of a habitat question. You know, they need the mix of agricultural and forest and the mixed habitat. And more importantly, they need great moth populations. Hmm. If you want to go to places that are not heavily sprayed, but the farther south in the state you get, the better your chances of running into whippoorwills.
Thanks, Harold, for the question. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Ann, I wanted to fit in.
Sure.
Wednesday, May 9th, there will be an evening of wine and warblers at the Grange Insurance Audubon Center starting at 5:30.
Are you going to be there?
Bill and I, my husband Bill Thompson and I, will be the featured authors, and we're going to take warbler walks. We're going to taste some wine. I plan to do more than taste it. There are hors d'oeuvres and desserts.
There's
a silent auction, and it's going to be quite fabulous.
That sounds like fun. Can I get you into the studio?
I would love that.
Okay.
I bet you could get both of
Bill,
them.
I know,
yeah.
Both of you.
Yeah, Wednesday, May 9th at 5:30 at the Grange Insurance Audubon Center.
Because we were going to mention that that's a great place near downtown for bird programs as well, if anybody's interested, and it's easy to find on the Internet, of course.
They've got terrific habitat there, too, that they're creating from nothing. It's just really wonderful.
From Lisa on Facebook, she says, I just checked out Julie's new book this week from the Westerville Library. We'll be buying my own copy soon. What
Wahoo!
A wonderful gift to all bird lovers.
Oh, thanks.
The name of the book, it's called The Bluebird Effect, Uncommon Bonds with Common Birds. My guest has been Julie Zicafus, natural history writer, artist, author, NPR commentator, and a guest coming up, I hope, on May 9th.
Yay!
With her spouse, Bill Thompson, who is the editor of Birdwatchers Digest.
And a pretty keen guy.
He is a keen guy. We've had him on the show before. He's almost as keen as you are. Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks, Julie.
Thank you, Ann.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for listening on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul McCartney talks with us from his home studio in England.
I happen to have a piano beside me here. It's like, besame, besame mucho.
And we hear recordings from his new collection of songs from his father's generation. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, providing a disciplined approach to help individuals and small businesses grow and maintain their wealth. TheMontgomerySolution.com.
49 degrees with sunshine in downtown Columbus. Expect sunny skies today and a high near 58. Clear skies for tonight and a low of 37 degrees. A mix of sun and clouds on Friday. Showers and thunderstorms likely Friday afternoon, a high of 65. And then some rain Friday night, a low of 41 degrees. This is 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to visit WOSU.org/allsides. You can listen and watch the show live weekdays from 10 until noon. You can also explore the audio and video archive. WOSU.org/allsides.
There was a time when a woman turned 50 that she might have heard something of a death knell, not an absence of life, but rather an absence of liveliness, when passion faded and possibilities became improbabilities. And looming ahead, one big void until death. That's changed, everyone knows. Suzanne Braun Levine, the first editor of Ms. Magazine, calls it the fertile void now, where there is potential for growth, a time to reimagine the possibilities. She's written a new book on the topic. We'll talk about that with her and Columbus's own hair theater creator, Pat Wimbrown, after the news. On All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.